You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of July, 2012, on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in a very sunny London with me, Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, as the countdown to the Olympics enters its final 24 hours, we ask the Brazilian Foreign Minister why the Games are so important.
Seldom, if ever, in the past, have two succeeding cities that will host the Olympic Games cooperated so closely. And this in itself, I think, is testimony to the strong and warm relations between Brazil and the United Kingdom at this point.
That was Antonio Patriotta. We'll also hear how Mumbai is changing its liberal attitudes towards drinking.
At the front gate, a bouncer is handing out slips of paper to all who enter. They're temporary liquor licences, as Mumbai police in recent weeks have launched a blitz against the city's drinkers.
The South Korean president, Lee Myung-bak, says he's so ashamed of the bribery scandal that surrounded members of his family, he can hardly lift his face.
I bow my head in apology to the people for causing concern over these matters. Who would I blame at this point? It is all my fault. I will willingly accept any reprimand.
And design editor Hugo MacDonald will be joining us in the studio. What's coming up, Hugo?
Well, Steve, I'm going to be playing you a song that's been dedicated to an architect, and I'm going to ask you to guess which architect you think the track is made for.
Intriguing. Thank you, Hugo. All that, plus we have a special discussion on the Olympics with sports writer Simon Cooper, and we'll also play some music. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. But before any of that, here's Barney Burnham with the latest news headlines from around the world.
Monocle 24 News at 6, I'm Barney Burnham. The wife of the Chinese political leader Bo Xilai has been charged with the murder of British businessman Neil Haywood, according to the state-run Xinhua news agency. Mr. Haywood was found dead on the 15th of November last year in his hotel in the town of Chongqing. Mr. Xilai is already in disgrace as a result of the affair, which is alleged to have been plotted by his wife, Gu Kailai. She's been prosecuted along with an employee at Bo's home. The UN has announced that it'll reduce to 150 the number of observers posted in Syria. This comes as the US confirmed that two senior Syrian diplomats have defected and reportedly fled to Qatar. They're the husband and wife team who are representatives to the United Arab Emirates and Cyprus. Meanwhile, Syrian rebels are reported to be preparing for a battle with government forces in Syria's second city, Aleppo. According to opposition activists, they've begun stockpiling ammunition and medical supplies as government forces prepare outside the city for a major confrontation. The activists claim artillery and helicopter gunships have resumed attacking rebel targets and 14 people have been killed. The UN's Under-Secretary General for Peacekeeping, Hervé Ladsou, still remains hopeful that a political solution can resolve the crisis.
We have to hope that the whole process gains traction, that the vicious circle of violence can cease, and that some political solution, and first and foremost some dialogue, some political dialogue, can get started.
Troika officials have met Greek finance leaders today to review Greece's progress on the €12 billion worth of cuts that are integral to the country's reform programme. Officials from the IMF, European Commission and European Central Bank met Greek finance minister Yanis Stournaras and the development minister for the crucial talks that will determine whether the IMF will give Greece a further rescue loan. In other European news, the euro and share markets rose today after European Central Bank President Mario Draghi pledged to do whatever was necessary to protect the eurozone from collapse, including fighting unreasonably high government borrowing costs. A campaign for a minute's silence at the London Olympics opening ceremony tomorrow to commemorate 11 Israeli team members who were killed at the 1972 Games has been refused by the International Olympic Committee. The campaigners, who included US politicians and relatives of the victims, wanted the silence to mark the 40th anniversary of the killings. The opening ceremony is expected to be watched by more than a billion people around the world. Daniel Taub is Israel's ambassador to Britain.
It was the darkest moment of Olympic history, and that is why it needs to be remembered. and needs to be commemorated appropriately and publicly to show that this message, that these ideals have not been forgotten.
The British Prime Minister David Cameron has defended the London Olympics after US presidential candidate Mitt Romney expressed doubts about the Games. Cameron said that London 2012 will show the world beyond doubt that Britain can deliver. Republican presidential hopeful Mitt Romney is in Britain to begin a week-long transatlantic tour, which will also include Poland and Israel. He'd said on NBC News that there were disconcerting signs of a lack of readiness for the Games. During a final visit to the Olympic Park before the opening ceremony, Mr. Cameron said all safety plans were in place.
I've personally chaired regular security meetings in the run-up to this, and I'm pleased to tell you that all plans, including detailed contingency plans, are in place. There are extra police on the streets of London, in the skies above and in the waters of the Thames, and they're backed by the finest armed forces in the world.
And those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. David Cameron also had a little sly dig at Mitt Romney, who, of course, organised the Olympic Games in 2002 in Salt Lake City, saying, of course, it's easier if you hold an Olympic Games in the middle of nowhere. There we are. It's 18.06 here in London. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. The Olympics is not merely a sporting event. It's also a diplomatic flurry of drinks receptions and side room bilaterals as hundreds of foreign dignitaries descend on London. One of those dignitaries, Brazil's Foreign Minister Antonio Patriotta, arrived in London last night. A little earlier, I popped down to the Ritz, where both he and President Dilma Rousseff are staying, to talk to him about the country's growing diplomatic might and, of course, what the Olympics means to Brazil. What brings you to London right now? And the importance of this trip for you and for Brazil?
Well, the president came to London for the Olympics, obviously, because Rio will be taking over the torch from London in 4 years' time. We have already established some agreements to share in the lessons learned from the British side. And the prime minister yesterday invited President Rousseff to 10 Downing Street. They had an opportunity to look not only at the sports cooperation side of things, which is moving ahead very well. I think seldom, if ever in the past, have two succeeding cities that will host the Olympic Games cooperated so closely. And this in itself, I think, is testimony to the strong and warm relations between Brazil and the United Kingdom at this point. The president invited Prime Minister Cameron to visit Brazil. He will be coming at the end of September. And we will be following up on the Olympics once they are over to enhance this dialogue and cooperation. Obviously, during their meeting, they also looked at trade and investment. The trade between our two countries is thriving. It's close to the $9 billion U.S. Dollar figure for two-way trade. There's science, technology, and innovation, which is a very promising area for cooperation, with many Brazilian students coming here to Britain under the Science Without Borders program. We also looked at some of the international issues on peace and security, and also the follow-up to Rio Plus 20. We're very pleased to welcome Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg to Rio a few weeks ago during this also very important event.
When you look at the importance of the Olympics, and of course you've also got the World Cup as well coming from Brazil in a couple of years, how important are those sporting events in helping to shape the image of a country?
Well, obviously image and reality go hand in hand. So what should be a priority, I think, in people's minds when they look at Brazil are the many accomplishments of the past years in terms of reconciling economic growth with social progress, reduction of poverty, eradication of hunger in a thriving democracy, and with environmental awareness. You put all of this together, and I think there are few countries at this moment who can present such a favorable picture. Brazilians are great sports enthusiasts. We've won the Soccer World Cup 5 times. This is the only country in the world who has accomplished this feat. And when it comes to other sports, we are also making a lot of progress. At Beijing, we won 15 medals. And the importance is to compete, obviously, not only to win medals. And this is a great event to bring people together, to overcome differences conflicts at a time of economic downturn and so much violence and strife in North Africa and the Middle East. I think the Olympics serve also to illustrate that, well, young people, athletes can come together and symbolize our common humanity, our common endeavor to overcome the limits of our physical bodies and share in a great, great event.
So is it more that when you look at the what Olympics and a World Cup can do, it's more about confirming to the rest of the world what you already know about yourself?
I think you could say that. We are a country that reaches out not only to the immediate neighborhood where we are working to create a zone of peace, democracy, prosperity, social progress, but also to the entire world. We have diplomatic relations with the entire United Nations membership, this in itself is maybe not all that common. In the Americas, for example, there are only two countries in this situation. So our accomplishments domestically, also our engagement with the international community, we are essentially a country that has an agenda for sustainable development and peace. So, you know, sports are also an element in bringing people together and promoting peace.
You've been working in the foreign ministry for rather a long time. You started when you were in your 20s, is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about how Brazil's role within the world has changed, how its foreign relations have changed over that time.
Well, they've changed quite considerably because if you go back a few decades, we were struggling not only with a very serious inflation problem, a debt problem. The economy was not at all in order. We were not a full democracy when I entered the diplomatic career. We were still under a regime that had been, well, you could describe it as a dictatorship. So there were numerous challenges. It was not a simple task to represent Brazil in the world. Although some of our strengths have been there for many centuries, territorially, population-wise, the creativity of the Brazilian people, our love of freedom, our love of sports and music and arts, and the diversity within Brazil that make up our strengths. So over the past three decades, I've been a diplomat now for a little over 30 years, I have seen Brazil emerge as a country that represents a successful model in many ways, as I was saying, in reconciling economic strengths, social progress. On the environmental front, there's been great progress also, reduction of deforestation. We have a very clean energy matrix, which is based very substantially on hydroelectric power. We have biofuels. We have also a thriving gas and oil industry, and we have an aircraft industry. So if you look at agriculture, Brazil has also become a powerhouse. Whatever the angle you look at today, politically, economically, socially, environmentally, culturally, it's an entirely different landscape.
That was Brazil's Foreign Minister Antonio Patriotta speaking to me a little bit earlier here in London. And you can read a full interview with Mr. Patriotta in the October issue of Monocle. Coming up next on today's Midori House, we'll find out all about a major corruption scandal in South Korea. You're listening to Midori House.
Thailand's famous hospitality is ingrained in our culture. From the warmest of welcomes to our culinary skill. That's why hospitality businesses like the world's best cooking school, Le Cordon Bleu, come to Thailand to sample our unique mix of exquisite cuisine and transcendent service. And all this against a soundtrack of fantastic homemade music. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Thank you. What Cannes is to film and Venice to architecture, the city of Arles is to photography. Our Monocle film crew headed down to the south of France for the opening week of the Rencontre d'Arles, the world's leading photography festival.
Photographers love a group hug. There's a lot of talk of apertures and shutter speeds and white balance in bars and parties across town. Everyone's at it, shooting everything in sight. Everyone's got their eye on everything and how everyone else might be framing it for a shot. It's a life through a lens in Arles.
Monocle Films. Focus on photography on monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. It is 18:15 here in London, 13:15 in New York City. The South Korean President Lee Myung-bak delivered a humble apology to his country on Tuesday as inquiries continue into alleged corruption by his family and former aides. This is what he had to say.
이러한 일들로 국민 여러분께 심려를 끼쳐드린 점.
I bow my head in apology to the people for causing concern over these matters. Who would I blame at this point? It is all my fault. I will willingly accept any reprimand.
President Lee now joins a growing list of South Korean politicians who promise to root out corruption, but who end up being mired in scandal themselves. Mr. Lee's case is particularly ironic due to his claim to be morally perfect. A little earlier, Emma Nelson and Christian Yeo spoke with a contributor in Seoul, Jason Strother, to ask what exactly Mr. Lee has been accused of.
Well, Lee Sang-duk, who is the brother of President Lee, he's accused of taking money, about $500,000, from the heads of two savings banks here in South Korea. Now, those savings banks, they had some problems with their books, so they went to the president's brother to ask for some political favors. Now, prosecutors here say that the brother of the president made sure that financial regulators didn't open up those books and, you know, prolong the lives of these banks. A lot of people lost their savings when the bank could no longer sustain what it was doing. So the prosecution says that if the investigation would have been unhindered years before, then these people could have saved their money. These banks wouldn't have kept the lie going.
And of course, it's had a huge effect on savers in South Korea. Anyone with more than 35,000 euros will have lost that money in those failed banks.
Right, and there have been some more safeguards put in place since these banks went under. Officials I know at the Korean Direct Deposit Insurance Corporation here, the KDIC, they were on site at these banks for many months, making sure that things went by the books. I can't say if everything is out, if they're all out of the woods yet, but the situation is much more stable for these savers now.
Now, as humble as the apology has been, the president hasn't actually been directly involved in any of these accusations, although it's more the association. Could that perhaps change? Could new evidence come to light?
Well, anything's possible in South Korean politics. I mean, President Lee, even when he was candidate Lee back in 2007, he was engulfed in a bribery scandal. He was cleared of those charges, but still many people think that he was taking money from another bank, the BBK Bank. So some people do say that he, you know, his hands aren't completely clean. But these current scandals, no, there's no sign right now that the president was involved. But he has fallen on the sword, more or less, on behalf of his brother's involvement.
Jason, how do you what do you think would have happened had President Lee, like you say, he fell on his sword? What do you think would have happened in terms of Lee's public persona had he not bowed deeply and apologised publicly on live television?
Well, President Lee, his popularity, the polls of his popularity, approval ratings, are pretty low as it is. He's in the 20 percentiles. His term in office is going to be over in February. He can't run again based on the rules of the South Korean Constitution. But what I do think, I think the bigger picture is that it absolves the responsibility of his ruling party, who is trying to continue with the presidency in the December polls. I mean, many South Koreans, especially many young South Koreans, see the ruling party as inherently corrupt, especially in terms of nepotism, other family, other bribery, other corruption scandals involving relatives of politicians. So I think by President Lee taking full responsibility on behalf of his brother, I think it's a more carefully crafted plan to boost the reputation of his party and those politicians, probably more so than himself. He has really nothing much more to gain after a few more months from now.
What is puzzling, however, is the sort of the situation in South Korea in terms of corruption within power. It was only 3 years ago that the former president threw himself down a ravine, you know, having said in a suicide note that he apologised for the corrupt life that he had led. How endemic is corruption in South Korean politics, and why can't they snap out of the cycle? Big question, sorry.
You're right, right. I mean, there could be cultural explanations. I think in East Asian cultures, there is a long history of giving gifts in returns for rewards. Some could draw comparisons to that. I mean, or just the nature of a Confucian society where you do whatever you can to please people in better social positions or more powerful positions than you are. But with that all said, I mean, South Korea was much more corrupt some years ago than it is now. So the prosecutors have been more independent. They have gone after big wigs, not only of the investigation of former President No, who you had indicated threw himself off of a cliff after his family was embroiled in a scandal with a shoe company during his presidency. The prosecutors have also gone after the Samsung president Lee Kun-hee, and that's as top as you can get. But however, at least in that scandal, he was eventually pardoned for his wrongdoings. So there's still a lot of room to go in ending bribery and ending these kind of corruption scandals here, but there is clearly tangible progress being made, though.
That was Monocle's contributor in Seoul, Jason Strother. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Hugo is up next. Now, all next week and the week after on Monocle 24, this show, Midori House, will not be broadcast from Midori House. Oh no, we're going on the road. Not very far. We're staying in London, but we're going to be broadcasting every day from a different... Well, they're called houses. Is that right, Hugo?
I think you would call them houses. You might call them outposts, temporary outposts.
Yes, they like to call them... I think it's a house. Somebody described them earlier as a hospitality thing, which I think was a bit wrong. Anyway,
it's a bit clinical.
Essentially, all the embassies in London, as the Olympics take place, are going to be creating their own special venues, and we're going to be broadcasting from a different one every single day from Midori House, starting with France on Monday. And Hugh McDonald, as Zionator, who's in the studio with us now, hello. We're doing one on a boat, aren't we?
We are. I'm looking forward to it. In fact, there's so many. It's so exciting. It's a really nice way to be able to cover the Olympics rather than just being trackside, which obviously we'll have a team of people there as well to bring us the latest sporting news, but to sort of be welcomed into the bosom of, I think, is it 10
different countries? So Japan, countries. Russia, Jamaica, France,
speaking,
I mentioned.
Yeah, to a mixture of
Denmark.
Diplomats, celebrities, and hopefully the odd athlete too.
You'd hope.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that would be good. So that's all next week and the week after on Midori House, 800 hours London time, in London, but not quite here. Now, Hugo, hello. Let's talk about design. We always talk about design on Thursday.
I was wondering if we were ever going to get there.
Yes, we will. We're going to talk about design. But it's like with a bit of a twist.
Yours is a bit of a twist. I don't know.
Steve,
I don't know if you remember Roger Sanchez. Back in, I think it may have been the year 2000, he had a fair to say global dance hit smash with a song called Another Chance. And I, for one, just sort of wrote him off and thought he'd come up with a good dance floor filler for one summer. But actually, it turns out I was very wrong indeed, because he is in fact a graduate of Brooklyn's Pratt Institute. He studied architecture there.
I wondered how you're going to bring us back to the design architecture.
I know, right? Just like to keep you hanging. And anyway, he, just a couple of days ago, released this song, which we're going to hear a little clip of. It's inspired by one of his favourite architects, and it's the first in a series of tracks that he's going to do composed around the style of his favourite architects.
But you're not going to tell us which architect it is?
No, I'm going to see if you can guess just from the music.
OK, go on then. Let's play a little bit of it.
I'll give you a prize if you can guess. Just about to get going.
If it was 4 a.m. and I was in fabric, then maybe.
Oh no. Well, now, can you guess who that is?
You know what? It sounds a little bit Zaha Hadidi.
Oh,
if you could even say.
I don't believe that you guessed. I think that it's maybe you've just.
You shouldn't have written it down on my script.
Well, it is actually. It's a song for Zaha Hadid, and what Roger Sanchez says is it's tech house, futuristic, minimal, but with lots of varying elements that are opposing but work together beautifully. It has an angular high at the end which conforms to the form of her designs, and there's a crescendo in the middle that reminds me of her focal points.
Wow.
I don't really understand that.
I didn't get all that, to be honest.
No, but when I was played it, someone asked me to guess, and I heard that sort of growling, grunting voice in the middle, and I thought, that can only be Zaha Hadid.
Really?
Yeah.
You genuinely guessed it?
No.
No.
But this is the first of a series. He's going to release a whole album in a few months, inspired by the likes of I.M. Pei, Frank Lloyd Wright, Tado Ando, Gaudi, Frank Geary. So I'm going to play Roger Sanchez and all of his architects' tracks on Section D.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
And Zaha Hadid obviously has an Olympics link as well.
She does. We can't do any story without talking about the Olympics. But poor Zaha in many ways, because her aquatic centre that everybody loved and thought was symbolic of great architecture that's landed in London for the Olympics has just come under fire because it's been revealed that 2,400 seats are not even on sale because the sight lines are interrupted by the design. You can't get a good view of the diving boards. She has been asked to sort of answer for this quite monumental failing to deliver or not deliver to a brief that was specified.
Well, I mean, also it was, you know, that there are two aspects to the design as well, because there are the temporary seats that are they're having now with the aquatic centre to make
wings,
sure that there's enough.
Exactly.
Yes, the wings for the for the thing, but it actually is going to look a lot better once those temporary seats have gone, is it not?
Seats go,
or supposedly.
I mean, I wonder if maybe the temporary seats were put there because they realised that there was this sort of epic, misjudgment. And they thought, goodness, we need to create some extra seating quick. Who knows? We'll hear more from Zaha, I'm sure, in the next couple of days. And she will most likely not cower into a corner. She'll come out screaming.
I'm sure she will.
To a dance track, maybe.
Yes, possibly. That giggling you can hear in the background is Barney Burnham, which means we're coming up to the bottom of the hour and we're about to have the news. Hugo, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House. In the next half hour here on Midori House, we're going to be hearing how Mumbai is clamping down on its liberal drinking laws. And we'll also be joined by Financial Times columnist Simon Cooper to talk Olympics, because we haven't talked enough about the Olympics really so far, have we? First, though, here's Barney with the news headlines.
Thanks, Steve. The wife of the Chinese political leader Bo Xilai has been charged with the murder of British businessman Neil Haywood, according to the state-run Xinhua news agency. Mr. Haywood was found dead on the 15th of November last year in his hotel in the town of Chongqing. The UN has announced that it'll reduce to 150 the number of observers posted in Syria. The news came as the US confirmed that two senior Syrian diplomats have defected and reportedly fled to Qatar. Troika officials have met Greek finance leaders today to review Greece's progress on the €12 billion worth of cuts that are integral to the country's reform programme. Officials from the IMF, European Commission and European Central Bank met the Greek finance and development ministers for crucial talks to determine whether the IMF will give Greece a further rescue loan. A campaign for a minute's silence at the London Olympics opening ceremony tomorrow to commemorate 11 Israeli team members who were killed at the 1972 Olympics has been refused by the International Olympics Committee. The British Prime Minister David Cameron has defended the London Games after US presidential candidate Mitt Romney expressed certain doubts. He'd said on NBC News that there were disconcerting signs of a lack of readiness for the Games, but Mr Cameron says all safety plans are in place. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London. Mumbai, or Bombay as it's still regularly referred to, is renowned across South Asia for its relatively liberal attitudes. Unlike elsewhere in the region, women are free to wear what they want, and bars and nightclubs are plentiful. But in recent weeks, police have decided to crack down on drinkers, leading to widespread concern that a moral crusade is underway. Monocle's New Delhi correspondent Aarti Bettigeri has more.
It's a regular busy Friday night at The Elbow Room, a fashionable bar in the laid-back beachside Mumbai suburb of Bandra. As usual, the bar is filled with the city's wealthy, expats and Bollywood hopefuls. But tonight, there's a small difference. At the front gate, a bouncer is handing out slips of paper to all who enter and warning people to hold on to them. They're temporary liquor licences, and a necessary part of imbibing these days, as Mumbai police in recent weeks have launched a blitz against the city's drinkers. They've invoked a 1948 law, which was last enforced in the 1970s, which requires people to carry a licence if they want a drink in a bar or a restaurant, or even if they have more than a few bottles of wine at home. Last month, a group of female actors and singers were arrested during a police raid on a restaurant and accused of being prostitutes. And during the Indian Premier League cricket tournament, revellers at a party were rounded up and tested for drug use. And in other incidents, bars have been fined for overcrowding or staying open too late or other transgressions. So in case there's a bust, bars want to be ready.
People are actually scared because you can just be arrested for almost anything. A woman was picked up from her 55-year-old woman was arrested from her house in Worli because she had a few bottles of liquor at home. Because under prohibition, you're not supposed to have any liquor with you. You know, you can't drink or possess alcohol.
That's Samrat Chowdhury, the editor of the Mumbai edition of the Asian Age daily newspaper. He says it all comes down to one man, an assistant police commissioner called Vasant Doble, who's decided to resurrect the law for reasons unknown.
There are several hypotheses floating around. One of them is that the government was short of funds and decided to raise money by sort of looking at all the possible licenses that they can get money from. So they became strict about the licensing, and it may be a result of that. It could also be just one individual trying to, make a mark.
There are numerous issues raised by the situation. One is about planning. Mumbai is notorious for its bad governance. Many of the bars are in neighbourhood areas, often on the ground floor of apartment buildings, so nearby residents have valid grievances when it comes to noise, parking and safety issues. Some commentators have also pointed out that it's all about authorities trying to keep Indian women in the kitchen. But perhaps most jarringly, it reveals just how antiquated many of India's laws actually are. In fact, the main criminal law, the Indian Penal Code, was drafted in 1860, when the British still ruled India. They came into effect shortly after the 1857 Indian uprising against the Raj, so it's believed the laws were a response to that incident.
Our laws are not in sync with the times. I think the reason, or one of the reasons that we fought for independence and bother to have an independent country with its own legislature and so many of these so-called legislators is so that we have our own laws. in keeping with the times. Now, if all our laws are still inherited from the British or still inherited from 1949, I don't know what our legislators are doing. If the legislators are doing nothing, then I don't see the point of having the legislatures. I don't see why they should be there at all.
Even bar owners, who have been cautious in speaking out to the media on the issue, agree that things need to change.
Obviously, you can't compare India to a fundamentalist state, but I mean, the laws have been in place for many years, and probably the law was more applicable for that period in time when it was in place. And now living in the 21st century, obviously India as a country has really moved on in terms of the average man's thoughts. Perhaps the laws need to reflect the same.
That's Ravi Sharma, whose family owns a string of bars and restaurants across the city.
Compared to other places in India, due to the safety aspect of Bombay, that it is considered to be one of the safest towns in India, even for females as well. So in that respect, I would say that the nightlife in Bombay is probably one of the most vibrant in the whole country.
Back at the Elbow Room, drinkers denounce the crackdown.
Bombay nightlife is always alive. It's more fun. And things like this coming into picture is actually disturbing it. But people are getting over it and they're just taking it as a joke and moving on.
I think the police need to actually concentrate on the rapes happening across the city, more criminal activity happening, rather than looking at liquor license. If somebody gets drunk, I don't think that's going to cause a big problem to the economy or to Bombay as such. But I think there are much more serious problems in the city that the police really need to pay their attention to.
Nicolo, I'm not talking. Watch me walk away.
Local authorities have promised to take a look at the laws governing drinking, although there's no time frame on when this might happen. But with this spat characterising the growing divide between old and new India, it's clear it's an issue in need of attention. For Monocle in Mumbai, I'm Archie Bechigeri.
It's 18:37 here in London. You're listening to Midori House. Coming up next, we'll be joined by Simon Cooper to discuss, because we haven't talked about enough, we really haven't, the Olympics.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Wherever you're going this summer, and whether it's for work or play, let Monocle's editors be your travel companions. We've just refreshed and revised our team's guides to the world's top business cities and resorts, so you can have our 25/25 travel guide series in the palm of your hand with the Monocle app, available from iTunes, or download free guides from monocle.com. From São Paulo to New York, Capri to St. Bart's, we can show you where to long lunch or go for your morning run. Just head to the iTunes App Store and download the Monocle app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're with Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. Over the past few days, London has transformed. The sun has finally come out, and we, the people, have finally learned to stop worrying and love the Olympics. Yes, we've griped, we've moaned, we've got very upset indeed about precisely how much time it's going to add to our journeys to work, but that's part of being British. And now it's finally here, we're all pretty much behind the games. And part of the reason London is so willing to open its arms to the rest of the world is because it already has. As Simon Cooper argued in his weekend column in the Financial Times, London is one of the most truly diverse cities in the world. And I'm pleased to say that Simon, who's also an author of author of numerous books on sport, including Soconomics, joins me right now. Simon, welcome to Midori House.
Thank you.
What is it about London that makes it different from other cities that we traditionally see as being diverse?
London, you don't just have what they call communities in other cities. There aren't really communities, and that people here actually mix all the time. I mean, 10 years ago, I left my shared house in Marylebone, less than a mile's walk from here, and it was owned by a British Indian, and the inhabitants included me from all over, a British Pakistani, French guy, an Italian who had come to work for the UK Treasury, so he was actually working for our finance ministry here, and a Japanese girlfriend, et cetera, et cetera. And in London, nobody even really notices that kind of thing. That's what really surprised me as a Londoner. I mean, I'm very aware of sort of ethnic issues. I would always notice that all these people were mixing. They didn't even see it. And the other thing is that if you can't mix, if you want to be in your community, you can't really function in London. You can't go to work. You can't go to the pub. And there's almost nobody to go to bed with if you're going to rule out people of other ethnicities.
And how does that differ then from, you know, other cities that we do think of, you know, you mentioned your piece, you know, Paris, Miami, Amsterdam, that have lots of different, as you say, communities that speak lots of different languages?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at these cities' websites, they talk about how many languages are spoken in their city. Yes, but very much in separation. I mean, both Amsterdam and Paris, when a large mass of non-white immigrants arrived from the 60s, built ugly social housing for these people outside the city with poor transport, often into the centre city. So if you go to the Bijlmer suburb in Amsterdam, very largely non-white, and then some office blocks where smart white executives have jobs. Paris, in Saint-Denis, it's the same thing. The non-whites were exiled, and so you get much less mixing. I mean, in Miami, there was a neighborhood that used to be called Colored Town for black people. And then when that became no longer acceptable, they called it Overtown. But it's still very much full of black people. Mm. And so in Miami, you can almost tell somebody's job by their ethnicity. So in the restaurant, typically, the waiter is a white person, and the person who takes away your dirty plates is not a white person. Those in London, that kind of distance, you see a little bit, of course, of it. There is a little bit of ethnicity-defining job, but infinitely less than in other cities.
And has that happened in London by accident or by design?
It was total accident for a very large amount of time. I mean, until the early 50s, London was quite a racist city. I mean, when people say there's centuries of diversity here, that's garbage, because there were very few non-whites and they were mostly treated badly. And so from the early 50s, you have this bombed city, pockmarked with holes all over, like here in Marylebone, where they later built car parks, and built social housing for poor people. So the social housing for poor people was built right in the middle of smart neighbourhoods. So you got a huge amount of mixing. There was no space to build new neighbourhoods in London because the city is very old. And so if you arrived as an immigrant, you just got a room or a house wherever you could and got on with it. And so the city is this unintended patchwork of different people often living in the same house, and they have to get on with it.
And do you think that then makes London, you know, particularly a good place to host Olympic Games? I mean, do you think that we're going to, you know, embrace everyone who comes here in a way that perhaps wouldn't have happened elsewhere?
Well, in London, you don't get embraced. They just put up with you.
Okay, no, that's true. Fair enough. Do you think we'll put up with people in a way that perhaps wouldn't happen elsewhere?
Well, we don't really care what colour they are, as long as they don't make our tube late.
As long as they stand on the right, they can do what they want.
Yeah, I mean, do not, you know, my tip to visitors to London, do not stand on the left in the underground, because you will annoy people like mad and they will not forgive you. And it doesn't matter how white you are or how black, they will be very upset. But they might not shout, but they will grumble.
They will indeed. When we turn our attention to the Olympics, you're going to be covering it yourself. I mean, what are the particular things that you're looking out for that you're excited about?
I know this city. I feel so well. I mean, I was at nursery school here. I, you know, was a young person here. And to see the city that you know well transformed into this Olympic venue, there's something very funny about that.
And do you feel it has?
It's going to. I mean, I was at the Olympic Park, and the Olympic Park was nothingness. It was the moon. And so now they've turned it into an Olympic Park. But, you know, a couple of times I used to walk down the road to Lord's Cricket Ground and I had indoor nets there as a cricketer. And now Lord's Cricket Ground is going to be the home of South Korean blind archers. And, you know, the mall and Horse Guards Parade, which I used to mock as a preserve of the upper classes, are now going to have very attractive ladies in short skirts playing beach volleyball there. So all these familiar venues transformed into something new. That's like what happens in dreams, that you walk through a familiar landscape and it's all new.
Now, you live in Paris now, and Paris obviously wanted the Olympic Games for 2012.
I don't think it did.
Really? You don't think they actually wanted it? No. They were quite annoyed, though, when they didn't get it, when London got it instead.
The bidders and the people who run the country were annoyed. You know, it was an insult to them. Chirac was insulted, and a very nice man called Philippe Baudillon, who was head of the bid, who was French establishment. I mean, he obviously wanted to get it. But, I mean, I was in front of the Hôtel de Ville, the town hall, on the day the announcement was made, July 5th, 2005. And we're all waiting there expecting, and the winner is Paris, because Paris was favourite. And of course, Paris would have done it much better than London. And
really?
Well, it would have been, it's a much more organised city, easier to get around. But the announcement came, the winner is London, and there was this, and then everyone went off shopping. So I don't think they were crushed. And I think Parisians are even more negative than Londoners, and they would have moaned even more had they actually got it.
Let's turn our attention to the actual sport itself. I mean, what are the main things that you'll be hoping to see? Are there any particular sports or particular athletes that, you know, not necessarily just the big names that you think would be really worth seeing?
Well, the dirty secret of the Olympics is that almost all the sports are intensely boring, and under normal circumstances, if they were happening in your back garden, you wouldn't open the blinds to see them, is what my colleague Matthew Engel likes to say. But I like football, and there will be good football. I like tennis, and there will be the best tennis. And I suppose one is supposed to say that you're trying to learn and embrace, you know, taekwondo and synchronized swimming, and I will do my level best to do so.
But you're not necessarily thinking, well, you know, the archery at Lourdes is going to be at this amazing event that I have to see because it's Olympics and it'll be brilliant.
No, I think it's more an event. It's more, I want to see London having the Olympics. I want to see people experiencing it and the human stories. I think that's what people, 95% of people, really care about, rather than this particular archer's new archery technique.
And just finally, I mean, we've talked about how, you know, it is in the last few days that everyone's suddenly sort of turned around, and even people that are griping all the time have suddenly gone, well, okay, it's here now, let's embrace it. Do you think we're going to enjoy it?
Well, all your listeners will read my column tomorrow where I say there is more enthusiasm, but people will continue to gripe, because you mock Londoners for complaining about someone making their tube journeys longer.
I don't mock. No, I do that as well.
Yeah, and rightly so, because this is London is a really hard city to live in and to function in. It's really expensive. The infrastructure just about works. You know, you rush to work, you rush home, you take care of your kids, you put them in bed, you finish your work. I mean, people here work the longest hours in the European Union. They have longest commutes. It's hard life in London, and the last thing a lot of people need is an Olympics to make it just on impossible.
But we'll still enjoy it just about.
Enjoy plus whinging, yeah.
Okay, good. Simon Cooper, columnist for the Financial Times and author of his latest book is Soconomics, written with Stefan Szymanski.
Szymanski,
almost there.
He's also a new Londoner. His father came here as a Pole, and there were signs in the windows saying rooms to let, no Poles, no Hungarians.
Not anymore, though.
No.
Simon, thank you very much indeed. Next, we're going to hear from Haiti about the Olympics. But first, here's a Midori House session performed earlier this week. This is Glass House by Postwar Years. That was Glass House by Postwar Years in a fantastic Midori House session, which took place, I think I said this week, that was a lie, it was last week, but it was still fantastic. If you want to hear Postwar Years and a special interview and a bit more from that session, download episode 41 of The Culture Show with Robert Bound, either on our website, monocle.com, or from iTunes. This is Midori House. Now, all countries are putting on a show here in London for the Olympics, and Haiti is no different. Discover Haiti is a new exhibition promoting the best art, clothing and home furnishings designed and produced in Haiti. And last night at the opening, our very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke with designer and Haitian enthusiast Donna Karen, and also with the Haitian Prime Minister Laurent Lamotte.
What does the Olympic mean for Haiti?
The Olympics is a way of showing the athletic processes of Haiti. We have athletes that we hope will make it to the finalist round, hopefully for medals. And also it's a way of showcasing that Haiti is back, that we've had a lot of trouble in the past. We've had embargo, we had natural disasters, we had an earthquake. So we had a lot of bad news, and now it's time for the good news, because after every disaster comes recovery. So we are at the recovery stage right now, and the Olympics gives us the platform to show that we are back, and we want to reestablish ourselves as a nation. And we have great hopes for these Olympics, and we're very excited about the team that we have here.
So if an athlete wins, it's going to be great for the country's image, don't you think?
Absolutely. This is what we're looking for, and this is what, you know, these athletes, they have 14 million Haitians, you know, rooting for them and cheering for them, and are excited to see them compete. And just being here also is good for us, because, you know, we have a small delegation. We have, of course, we're a small country. We have five athletes competing, and we'll be supporting them 200%.
And what's the importance of sport in the country? I know you quite like football as well. I'm from Brazil, so I heard that Haitians love football.
Yes, indeed. Sports in general is very big. The government is going to build 140 sports complex in every commune in the country, plus 9 large stadiums, multi-sports. So football, basketball, volleyball, and handball, including a school. So this is, we've decided that sports and the youth movement in general is centered around sports. So it's something that's positive for generations to come. So this is why we're committed to investing in the sports infrastructure and investing in sports in general.
Also in the event was designer Donna Karen, who with her Urban Zen Foundation was directly involved with the Discover Haiti exhibition. She told us a bit more.
When I first went to Haiti after the earthquake, I had a vision that really to deal with the developing world is to realize the artists. You know, and I think my model for Haiti is Bali, because when I think of Bali and I think of how it's preserved its culture, which is very important to me, how it's recycled and built in bamboo, you know, that it has all the artists and has the tourists and has a magnificent setting of preserving its culture. When Haiti was hit, it became very obvious to me that I think there's a model to be had. I do a lot of work in Bali, my Urban Zen work that I do. I've started a company called Urban Zen, which is preservation of culture, healthcare, and education. And Haiti fit into all of those primary aspects, all of mind, body, and spirit. When I went to Haiti, I was, as the vision had seen, everybody there is an artist. There's no question about it. And I think giving people's work and acknowledging their creativity is one of the very important things of rebuilding a country, because with the creativity comes creation. So what I was able to do is to work with the artisans to develop product. I called on a friend of mine, Russell James, who does Nomad Two Worlds, which is the preservation of culture in Australia with the nomads. And I said, you must come to Haiti immediately. I see the opportunity here from a photography point of view, from a fashion point of view, from a product point of view, and started developing product with all the people all over the country. And whether it's in Jacmel, Quartier Bouquet, Port-au-Prince, Lagan, every person is an artist within its own community. So I work with the artisans and develop product and created a collection that we sell at Urban Zen. And it's sold in New York, LA, and in Sag Harbor, Long Island. We also have it on the website. And there's a film that shows the whole journey, which is really been a remarkable, truly heartfelt. So my mission right now is to become, you know, inspire other designers to go to Haiti, to work with the artisans, to develop more product. Now that the industrial park is being built, hopefully fashion, you know, people could be manufacturing there, certainly from the United States. It's so close. It's a lot easier for me to get to Haiti, unfortunately, than to Africa or India, but nevertheless, Haiti's opportunity and the creativity that comes out of Haiti is remarkable.
That was Donna Karen, and before that you heard Lauren Lamotte and the voice of our very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco. That's it for today's Midori House. Do tune in to the Monocle Daily a little bit later, 2200 hours. They're going to be talking about the second mysterious pig-like creature to be washed up outside of New York. I know you want to stay tuned for that. The news is next. Then it's The Urbanist. Midori House, don't forget, all next week, coming from different places all around London. Do listen to them. Until then, I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.